any reason. So there are some other mechanisms. This happens to specifically focus on the workers' comp situation. One point that I would like to make with regard to COBRA, since I also have to deal with that landmark federal legislation, is, in fact, COBRA is permissive in terms of who pays for the continuation of health insurance. What has interested me about this particular bill is that it has moved from what appeared to me to be the initial problem of an individual, regardless of what their circumstances were for losing their coverage, from them having access to continued coverage to who, in essence, pays for it. And under COBRA, in fact, an employer can pay for the health insurance continuation if they so desire through a collective bargaining agreement or any other type of provision that they may have.
Is there any problem with guaranteeing access right now under COBRA? The fact that you filed a workers' comp claim or not doesn't affect your opportunity to cover under COBRA, does it?
No, it does not.
All right, thank you.
Further questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe maybe for you or for the witness, the COBRA is an employee contribution.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edmondson, it is permissive in that regard. It does not mandate that it's employer paid.
Oh, okay. So employer is not under any obligation to pay under COBRA, but they would be under this bill.
Right. And in our particular, just as an example, because of the complexity of collective bargaining agreements that exist among cities, where sometimes they will pay for leaves of absence for whatever reasons, they've negotiated continuation for injured workers and the rest. From our standpoint in administration, as far as we're concerned, all of these people are on COBRA, and the local jurisdiction can pay or not pay depending upon what kind of personnel policies and collective bargaining agreements they may have.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question.
Sure.
Peggy's as familiar with this bill as anybody from her side of the fence, and I just want to get her point of view here. I'm back on page one of the bill, the bold-faced material that sets up the duty to do this in the first place. Says basically it's unlawful to terminate the health insurance as a result of the injury or illness for which claims been filed. It says except as provided for in Section 4. Now, Section 4 is the whole enforcement arm of this. Now, what in the heck is it? Why is there an exception there? Can you give me any?
My understanding in watching this bill evolve is that what that is intended to say is that what that is intended to accomplish is set forward the termination provisions for the continuation of the coverage.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Domini.
Pardon me for being a few minutes late, so maybe the question has already been asked 100 times and answered equally as many times. But as I see this, the original bill just addressed all employers. And in its final engrossed version, it only addresses public employees. Can somebody explain to me what happened to us in the private sector in the meantime?
That was mentioned, but Peggy, you want to take a crack at that?
In fact, one of the explanations is, in fact, that the private employment community would not be affected because of the number of self-insured employers who are exempt from insurance mandates as a result of ERISA. My perception is that it has been more of an issue with the public employer bargaining units than it has been with the private sector. And one of the ways of getting around the technical difficulties of trying to write a bill that was in the insurance code that dealt with workers' comp issues and federal COBRA issues, it was basically proposed that the bill be put in the current series of statutes and address only the public employer community.
That's the second time in about 3 days that I've heard that those of us in the private sector are not required by mandates where we are, because most of us are in trusts that are required by mandates. And any mandate that comes upon our trust is something we live with.
the same as people in the public sector. And again, I'm seeing a different direction for public than private. That disturbs me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominey, essentially what it comes down to is the whole question of how you purchase your insurance. And if you were covered under the Timber Operators Council, you may well have a more conventional form of health insurance than, say, for example, Tektronix or other Weyerhaeuser employees who are self-insured. In fact, there is an increasing portion of the private employer community in the state that are going self-insured so as to have the flexibility to decide their own benefits. It is also true that there are a number of large trusts that are also subject to the different mandates in the insurance code depending upon who the carrier is that they have. Without getting any more technical than that, you have one set of requirements that would affect you if you have your coverage through Blue Cross versus if you have your coverage through Kaiser or if you have your coverage through Aetna, which happens to be a commercial carrier.
Pig, I had just one question. I was going to ask Mary this and forgot, but you referenced it also. And that's when you talk about it, both in the bill and in your suggested language, you talk about acknowledging the responsibility to pay required premium contributions. Are we talking a copay here? Is that what you're...
Yes. Representative Shiprock, the way that the language is set up, there may well, in fact, be an employee-employer shared contribution towards the premium. And the way the bill is presently written, it requires the employer to send a notice and let the injured worker know what the requirements are in order to continue the benefits. And what we had suggested, since the employer is obligated to send out the notice and in fact is obligated under the current language to provide 30-day grace period in terms of a late premium, we thought it would be an appropriate matter to have the injured worker respond affirmatively that they wanted to elect the coverage. Mary Botkin could correct me, but I think that their general feeling was that was too much of a burden on the injured worker to respond. Our concern was that, in fact, that there was a complete understanding on all parts, and I would say that that may be an even bigger issue at this point, depending upon what happens with Senate Bill 291 in this committee in terms of punitive damages and a jury trial for failure to comply with the provisions of 296.
You know, I'm going to have Max look at that. I don't want to take committee time, but I'm not seeing your correlation between the two bills, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I want to look at that. It's not what I thought that bill did. That's the extent of my questions. Colleen, did you have any testimony?
Just quickly, for the record, Colleen Haas, Local Government Personnel Institute. The business industry, and in particular Associated Oregon Industries, has asked to be on record that they join us in opposition to the bill. Although the private employers have been exempted from the bill, they have taken a formal stand in opposition to the bill as bad public policy, and they ask that they be on record while we're here to that effect.
May I inquire?
Yes, Representative Mathis.
In regard to that, now the bill also repeals ORS 743.532. In terms of your opposition to this bill, you don't mind seeing that statutory provision remain in effect? Are you taking a position on that?
Chairman Shiprock, Representative Mannix, you have me at a distinct disadvantage.
Representative Mannix?
I don't have the statute in front of me. I have no idea what it is.
Would you share with us what that particular reference
That's
is,
the statute
532?
Sure. It provides for continuation of group health policy coverage for permanent employees after injury or illness covered by workers' compensation. And it says, in addition, it's a lengthy provision, but basically it says if you have an injury covered under Chapter 656, the employer will cause the policy to continue in effect with respect to that employee by timely payment of the premium, and it continues for up to 12 months with certain cutoff events. It does say that it talks about an injury covered by Chapter 656, which means a compensable claim.
Mm-hmm.
But then it talks about during which time a compensation claim is filed. Now,
that's the self-pay provision, essentially.
Right. Now, there is a provision that this is cut off if the claim is denied and the claimant fails to appeal. But if there's an appeal pending, it sounds like the provisions are that there is a continuation of coverage.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Yes, Representative Edmonds.
I think, isn't that the law that was passed in 1987?
That's what Max just
said. That applies to private as well as public employers. It did not apply to health contract providers or whatever the Blue Cross folks were. And that's why we had to go back and try to change the law, because the previous law only applied to certain categories of insurer. This new law applies only to certain categories of employers, specific public employers. And apparently, the private industry doesn't want to doesn't want out from under the 1987 law for those who were covered by it. So I appreciate that position, and I'm glad to know that industry wants to continue these benefits.
Well, they took no position just now. At least I didn't hear a position.
Oh, she said it was that this bill was bad public policy, and they must think it's bad public policy to repeal that act. So appreciate that.
Well, it is repealed in the bill.
It is repealed in the bill.
Yes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, Bruce Bishop.
You being cute.
Before they had to sign up.
Oh, Mondays.
Mondays.
Good morning, Bruce.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, representing Kaiser Permanente. We were involved last interim in the deliberations of the suggestions to amend House Bill 2824 from the 87 session, which led to the introduction of Senate Bill 334, which the Senate Labor Committee amended as Senate Bill 296, which you have before you today. Because of that involvement, I merely wanted to advise the committee that the concerns that we had previously during the interim and with Senate Bill 334 have been remedied in the way that 296 is drafted, and so we have no further concerns as an insurance carrier about the approach that's included in 296.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edmonds.
Kaiser was covered under the 1987 Act.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmonds, and that's incorrect.
Oh, it was not. You were one that was not covered.
That's correct.
Okay. I see.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmonds, and Kaiser Permanente and all other health maintenance organizations are organized and licensed as healthcare service contractors.
Okay.
So the 1987 law only applied to indemnity insurance companies, not to healthcare service
such
contractors.
Such as?
Aetna, First Far West.
If a private employer had health insurance through Aetna, for example, the 1987 Act would require that private employer to continue to pay health care.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, that's correct.
And this bill, by repealing the 1987 Act, would excuse the private employer from any requirement to continue that sort of coverage.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, that's correct. If that employer had health insurance coverage through one of those insurers that was subject to the Act.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mannix.
I'm going to ask you this question. You might not be able to answer it, but it's also a general philosophical question that I'd address to anybody about this bill. It seems to me that we're taking workers who have health insurance coverage and discriminating in their favor against workers who don't have health insurance coverage in terms of an added benefit under the workers' comp system, whether or not the claim is ultimately compensable. And if we are trying to address the problem of continuation of health care, shouldn't we just say that any injured worker may participate in some government-sponsored fund separate from employment, whether or not their claim is finally allowed, avoid all the bureaucratic BS that we've had to build into these systems, and say, here's a fund that's available if you have an injury claim, and maybe we shouldn't even say on the job or off. I'm just throwing out this question as something that I wonder why it's not addressed more broadly and more philosophically as to allowing people who have had a health insurance or don't have health insurance, either way, to lock into some coverage. And maybe I'm coming at this backwards. Maybe we should be addressing this from the whole question of universal health insurance, because we're coming around to this in little edgy ways. Have you worked with any group that has addressed the issue as to what we really can do about providing continuation of benefits for people in a variety of circumstances?
not just people who happen to have had industrial injury claims.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I think that is a well-founded concern, and what this and many other legislative proposals that come before you would try to do is to reconcile two different health insurance systems, one that's the non-industrial related system, the general health insurance system, and the other, the workers' comp system, and trying to mesh those two systems doesn't work very well. I think one of the thrusts behind the proposal that you have here was not just to assure continuing health insurance coverage for the worker who was injured, because in many instances that worker's injuries and illnesses will be covered through the workers' comp system. The concern was as well to address dependents and spouses and other family members whose coverage would be terminated because the workers' comp system doesn't pay for those. Clearly, all of these kinds of approaches are piecemeal patchwork solutions that don't address having an adequate universal health insurance system available regardless of the source of the injury. But I think that that's probably an issue that's a ways down the road for us to really be able to address effectively.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Just an idea, and I don't know what the ramifications would be because it just popped into my mind. But it seems to be the intent of the legislature to extend health insurance benefits to as many people as possible, and we're over the sessions advancing a number of ideas how this can be. One of those that we're dealing with is that that employers, small businesses, will provide health insurance for their employees. What the suggestion I have, or the thought that I have, is it sometimes happens that once you're into a group, you have rights to reaccess that group forever. I had that experience as a fighting dentist. I had access to United Services Insurance Agency, and so did Representative Bierfer. Now, once having been in that, I can go back in that forever. That group policy is always available to me, life insurance, health insurance, car insurance, whatever. It may be that there might be some justification for saying that once a person, an employee, is in a group health policy or a group insurance policy in the state of Oregon, that they would always have access back into that on a self-pay basis. Now, I have no idea what the ramifications of that would be. They might be horrendous. There also might be some benefit to it. It would certainly extend health insurance to a larger number of people.
Yeah, Rep. St. Hayden, I think the federal government under the COBRA legislation that we've talked about here, I'm aware of at least 18 months, and I think in some cases up to 2 years.
Mr. Chair, I believe 36 months.
36 months you can get now under COBRA, which is the federal act that covers everybody. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Mary Ann Guest.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Ann Guest, representing the Oregon School Employees Association. We would like to support Senate Bill 296. We were involved in House Bill 2824 and the passage of that bill in 1987. We have worked hard on it. We have tried to address everyone's concern. It has been amended and amended and amended. It has been debated in the interim committee, in a subcommittee of the interim committee, labor committee. In the Senate, we also formed another subcommittee and debated the bill. I honestly believe we have worked hard on the bill and it deserves your support. The bill, in its original form, was to affect private and public employees. It passed the Senate unanimously, and it also passed the House, I think it was 43-8. People, legislators, agreed that this was a good benefit for a group of people that did not deserve to lose their health care insurance just because they were injured on the job. During the Senate's review of this bill, it was amended for a variety of reasons, deleting private employers and employees from the bill. We reluctantly agreed to that. We do not believe that private employees should not receive the same benefits as public employees do. But because of a vote count, several vote counts, we just had to do it. We had to delete them from the bill, to be honest. Senate Bill 334's concept, which was the original bill this session, was amended into Senate Bill 296, making it a ULP for public employers to cancel health insurance benefits when an employee is injured on the job. Health insurance would be provided for up to 1 year unless one of the events listed in Section 4 occurred. I would like to highlight from a testimony submitted by Mrs. Cynthia Zielinski in April 1987 to the Senate Labor Committee regarding the need for this type of legislation. Mr. Rick Zielinski, her husband, was employed by the Salem-Keizer School District for 4.5 years as a custodian. He was covered by Blue Cross insurance. He was injured on the job March 1986. He had 4 surgeries between March 86 and June 86, resulting in the loss of his leg. The school district did not accept or deny his claim until 2 weeks before his death in February 1987. The result was the district was fined $2,000 for failure to accept or deny the claim within the specific time frame. He received continuation of health insurance for a short time from the district due to accrued sick leave and vacation. After this, there was simply not enough money to pay the 120 monthly premium to continue the health insurance through his employer. The school district would not allow premium payments for health insurance to be spread out over the month as the Zielinskis had requested. The district demanded full payment for the premium at the first of the month. Due to that problem and with their rent, their food, utility payments, and the fact that they were getting paid twice monthly instead of right up front in the beginning of the month, they just didn't have the money at the first of the month to continue that premium. Mrs. Zielinski, as I said, was paid twice a month, and Mr. Zielinski was also paid twice a month. If the district had allowed them to make their premium payments twice a month, they would have tried to keep the insurance. Since their request was denied, they dropped their health insurance. Mr. Zielinski had a history of diabetes. He had to take insulin, glucose, special diet foods. The cost of his diabetes problem ran about $250 a month. The choice for them was often between food and insulin. Mr. Zielinski became frustrated. His mental attitude quickly deteriorated during the year. It was a combination of a lot of factors, all related to the on-the-job injury. The surgery and loss of his leg. The insurance company kept changing caseworkers and putting off a claim. It was on deferred status. The school district would not accept or deny the claim. There was a series of hearings. Letters and phone calls from doctors and hospitals to pay bills from surgeries incurred from the on-the-job injury. The insurance company was not paying the bills. The Zielinskis were barely keeping up with their own bills. The utility company sent disconnect notices. Zielinskis had 2 small children. They needed their heat and electricity. Combination of stress, insulin shock resulted in death for Mr. Zielinski. He went into insulin shock quite a bit during these last few months. They could not afford paramedics or hospital treatment. The wife was handling all the problems. They were having problems with their children and all related to their father's condition. Additional stress on the parents over this. Mr. Zielinski died of a massive heart attack February 1987 at age 38. To quote Mrs. Zielinski in 1987, House Bill 2824 could have helped us financially and eliminated some of the stress we underwent because we would have at least had health insurance to cover my husband's diabetes problems and other health problems normal families incur with small children. This is a very unique case, but we feel it is significant in showing the need for this type of legislation. Unfortunately, though we passed the law in 1987, it still wouldn't have helped the Zelenskys because Mr. Zelensky was covered by Blue Cross. We hope this committee will correct the technical flaw that was found in House Bill 2824 from 1987 and support Senate Bill 296. This bill, as I said, has been debated and amended and amended. And we believe it is now ready for your support. Thank you.
Chair. Representative Domini.
You heard my concerns a few minutes ago about the private sector and how, it's from my perspective, where we have indemnity, ORS, is, what is it, 743.532 is good. And when you repeal it, it becomes very bad. Would you be opposed to taking out the repeal of that section?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Domini, as I said at the beginning of my testimony, we reluctantly agreed to take the private employees out because we did not have enough votes for the bill with the private employees in the bill, to be honest. Now, I believe, as in 1987, I have not changed how I feel about the bill. The bill was a good bill. It should cover both private and public employees, yes. Unfortunately, in 1989, we don't have enough votes to do that.
From my perspective, Mr. Chair, I just find, again, hard to support something that taketh away from me to give to you.
I understand.
Well, we'll have a chance to do something about that,
Representative Domini. That's an amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Aiden.
After 5 years here, it seems to me that the plurality of all the legislation are people jockeying for position. It's a very disheartening thing to me, I must say, Mr. Chairman, that many of the bills we hear are one group of people striving for advantage over another group of people.
Any further questions of Marianne? Thank you very much. Anybody else on Senate Bill 296?
Time on it, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Hafner. I represent the Oregon School Boards Association. I don't want to waste your time reiterating what's already been said, but I did want to put on the record that the Oregon School Boards Association opposes Senate Bill 296. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Any questions,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Walden.
In Mary Ann's testimony, she quotes an OSBA article that the bill was flawed. Do you know about that? Can you address that article?
Representative Walden, Mr. Chair, Representative Walden, without seeing it, I'm not certain. I know we agree with Peggy Annett in her assessment of the bill, and so perhaps those are the flaws that she's discussing.
Were you done?
Yes.
Representative Edmonds.
Just to follow up on Representative Walden's question, wasn't the flaw, as Mr. Bishop explained, that the health contract maintenance, whatever Kaiser and those folks are called, that those people were not included within the definition of health insurance, and so it only applied to the Aetna private indemnity insurers and not to the health maintenance organizations? I think that was the flaw. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, I'm sorry, I must have misunderstood the question. If we're talking about the piece of 87 legislation, yes, that was the flaw. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman?
You were Representative Mannix.
Maybe I shouldn't ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If that was the flaw in the 1987 legislation, why are we not presented with a simple amendment to ORS 743.532, which clarifies the organizations which are subject to that statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I was not a participant in the interim committee that worked on this bill. My guess would be that fixing that to do so would cause the bill not to pass pass at the Senate and the House chambers.
Is there? All right. Thank you.
speak, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, question of the witness. Is that because it would have remained contingent on both public and private employers to provide this coverage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, that would be my guess.
And it would have extended coverage on, it would extend to the obligation of public and private employers to insure through an expanded universe of coverers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, as I understand it, self-insured employers would still not be covered.
No.
But even as I understood it, now I may be wrong, I'm not an expert in this, but there was no real way to cover self-insured employers. And there may be some way that I'm not aware of, but that was how I understood it.
Okay. Self-insured, Representative Hayden, are not subject to state insurance law. So that's why it would not affect self-insured employers. As far as health care is concerned, obviously in workers' comp there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 296 and move to... Legislative Council does something called conflict amendments, and they have to watch this very carefully how these bills are going. So your concern would be dealt with. This bill, if given your scenario, both would pass, both would become law, but they would
blend it together.
I don't know. Well, they don't blend them together exactly, but
what would
I'm
happen
not sure exactly how it works. But
Representative Shiprock, if I may, I believe that if you had them both on the books, that there would be no problem, because
right.
It is not unusual to have a specific group defined inside of a broader group so that you're certain that the coverage is workable. There is no conflict between the two bills.
Right.
And I think one bill would cover the other. I think the other bill is of a general nature such that it would be argumentative in some cases as to whether specific people are covered. I speculate that 2841 would cover the people that I'm concerned about. That doesn't mean that somebody else might not speculate that it did not cover those people. The provisions of Senate Bill 1015 are absolutely clear as to who it covers, and when we were at the Senate committee, we even submitted by name the people that were currently holding those positions. So we know exactly who's covered, and there are 45 of them.
I suppose, Mr. Chairman, as long as it's clear on the record that we discern no conflict between the two provisions, legislative council can take care of it. We can also avoid the extra step in the process of amending a bill so that there has to be even concurrence in the Senate. We could just pass it and say, here we are. It seems to me the straightest route.
Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
I'll take a little different approach than Representative Mannix did, John. I think I would like to see in all four bills that we're passing out of this committee consistent language, and listen to this language and see if this would be agreeable to you in that it's consistent with other bills that we've passed out. We would say, who are required to hold valid Oregon teaching certificates and whose primary job description involves the custody, control, treatment, investigation, or supervision of juveniles placed in such schools. We've used that last clause repetitively in several bills. Does that accomplish what you need to do?
It probably does.
It just says these are people who have teaching certificates and whose primary job description places them in close contact with these people. This isn't somebody who happens to have a teaching certificate.
Well, that's the reason of the language in 1015, because they would have to hold the position that the certificate was required for.
All right. Now, what would this do with a... an administrator, perhaps one who never went to Hillcrest.
That wouldn't do anything. The reason that you can't just have the hold the teaching certificate and be employed there is because you might by chance hold the teaching certificate and not be working in that category. So you have to have the job that requires the certificate. That was necessary in the narrowing in the purpose of defining the unit into the 45 people. We believe it's pretty clear who's covered because we put it on the tapes sufficiently, and we've also submitted by name, so that identifies every position that's covered under the bill, so we don't think there's any way that it can be extended beyond what the bill has proposed.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative,
I just, I was going to make that point that you'd already said there were 45 and you did it by name. Just one little thing. I wasn't here when you first started. In the 2841 testimony, we heard that, you know, that all three of the Crips, Bloods, and Skinheads were all in the same, they're being housed together. And I assume that they're not segregated in the classroom either, are they?
No, they're not. In fact,
okay,
it's...
Well, that's all I wanted, Mr. Chairman, to get that one there.
I don't know that you can actually identify if they're members of those gangs in all instances.
You don't let them wear their colors?
I'm going to catch them with their spray paint.
Okay. Let's go into work session on Senate Bill 1015.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hayden.
An amendment to Senate Bill 1015, please. After the word certificate on line 37, page 3, delete the balance of the next, of line 37, 38, and 39, and insert the words, whose primary job description involves the custody, control, treatment, investigation, or supervision of juveniles placed in such schools. Mr. Chairman, this is just a technical amendment to make the language consistent with the other bills that we've passed out. I'm willing to support Senate Bill 1015. I don't think it's necessary. I think 2841 does the job nicely. I'm philosophically opposed to the shotgun approach where we introduce multiple bills hoping that one will get through rather than debating the policy on one prime bill. But I also realize political pragmatics, and I'm prepared to support this bill.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Hayden has moved the new language. I'm having committee counsel look at that. That changes the intent in the way.
Representative Hayden, did I understand after on line 37 after certificates to strike the rest of the bold faced and insert whose primary job description, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. It's not my intention to change the meaning of the law at all, of your proposed bill at all. If that does so, will the administrator please so advise me.
I don't think it does. And if the I had said already I thought that those certificated teachers would be covered under 2841, and that is the language from 2841, so I don't see any problem with that.
Okay. To the motion. Representative Mannix and Representative.
After 4.5 months as a legislator, I've learned that to respect and appreciate the reasons why people take a shotgun approach to legislation. I wish I could file bills in the Senate myself.
Another election.
You can.
No. That's right. I mean both sides.
Pick up on what he meant there.
Just so you can jumpstart the legislation. I appreciate the desire for consistency, and if we were working up our own bill here, or if we were dealing in a conference committee with a bill and we knew it was going to have to go back for a vote, I'd say, gee, let's make sure the language is consistent. But as long as there's no material conceptual inconsistency with the other bill which we've passed, and there is not, I would prefer to avoid any opportunity, any more trip levers in the system that we can avoid. So with all due respect, I oppose that amendment.
Representative Edmondson.
Well, I just wanted to say that the earlier, the 2841 language does not include the word teaching, and I don't know if did he include the word teaching? The word teaching appears in 1015, and I sure wouldn't want any interpretation that we were somehow that only non-teachers who hold certificates were going to be allowed to this.
Did you have a comment?
I think one of the things, Representative Hayden, that the reason we put this language in the others was because we needed to have something from a general to a specific kind of an idea. 1015, when you get right to it, has a specific because it requires a valid Oregon teaching certificate and then these other things. So I don't think that it's necessary to have whose primary job description. I think the limiting factor in that is the teaching certificate. So.
Okay, I think those are cogent arguments, and if the committee agrees, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. We don't need any more conference committees either. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Not that we've had any yet.
We will.
Last session. Okay. Representative Hayden withdraws his proposed amendment to Senate Bill 1015. Am I on the right?
That's
1015.
A and B. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
I move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Mannix moves Senate Bill 1015 A engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Gerfler? Aye.
Representative
Downey?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative
Johnson? Aye.
Representative Hayden?
Aye.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Walton?
Aye.
Representative Witte?
Aye.
Chair Shiffack?
Aye. Senate Bill 1015 A engrossed sent to the floor with a due pass. Volunteers. Representative Dürfler. Okay. Senate Bill 1051.
Larry Hill is on Senator Hill.
Is Senator Hill present? This is that whistleblower bill. On this particular bill, there was a memo from the executive department distributed before the meeting. Put that in the bill file, please. Maybe read it. Senator Hill is available?
He was in the room a minute ago.
No, too bad. Oh. Almost saved.
Senator Hill, we're on Senate Bill 1051.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask a couple other individuals
sure.
to join me for efficiency.
Appreciate that.
Come on up.
No, your time is precious. Mr. Chairman, I'm Senator Larry Hill, District 21, for the record. I'm the chief sponsor of Senate Bill 1051. The bill is the whistleblower law. There are problems in state government that arise from time to time because of mismanagement, abuse of authority. Funds are spent in ways they shouldn't be spent. Even criminal activity may occur from time to time. It's important that employees who witness these things be in a position to be able to report them to the proper authorities if they are not resolved within the agency. The whistleblower law is intended to protect employees who report these kinds of activities when they have reasonable grounds to believe they are true. There are protections in there against abuses by employees, and I'd like to go over the bill and explain what it does. It does really three different things within the whistleblowing label. First of all, we have some definitions. The bill only applies to public employees and public employers. It does not apply to private sector. Section 3 is really the meat of the bill. It provides that no public employer shall prohibit any employee from discussing in response to an official request either specifically or generally with any member of the Legislative Assembly or Legislative Committee staff acting under the direction of a member of the Legislative Assembly, the activities of the state or any agency of or political subdivision in the state, or any person authorized to act on behalf of the state or any agency of or political subdivision in the state. As legislators, we need to know what's going on in state government. We need to be able to make reasonable inquiry of employees and department heads and assistant department heads, about what's going on. If material is not required to be confidential by state or federal law, rule, or regulation, we should be able to talk about it in our official capacity to find out what's going on in the state. Otherwise, we'd only be dependent upon the company line represented by the executive department. It's important to have these informal avenues of communication. Second, in Section 3, on line 6, page 2, no public employer may prohibit any employee from disclosing or take or threaten to take disciplinary action against an employee for the disclosure of any information that the employee reasonably believes is evidence of a violation of any federal or state law, rule, or regulation, mismanagement, gross waste of funds, abuse of authority, or substantial and specific danger to public health and safety resulting from action of the state agency or political subdivision, or subject to subsection 2 of section 5, the fact that a person receiving services, benefits, or assistance from the state or agency or subdivision is subject to a felony warrant for arrest issued by this state or any other state or the federal government. This section speaks to revealing the fraud, waste, and mismanagement which an employee has reasonable grounds to believe has occurred or is occurring. Also, it protects the employee for following the directives of subsection 2 of section 5 and revealing that someone receiving state services is a wanted felon or is probably a wanted felon. I'll go on down and we'll get to that subsection. I'll explain how that works. Also, in subsection 3, there's a provision that the employer may not require any employee to give notice prior to making such disclosures, and that the employer may not discourage, restrain, dissuade, coerce, prevent, or otherwise interfere with disclosure. And finally, that no public employer shall invoke or impose any disciplinary action against an employee for employee activity protected by this section. Section 4 is a list of exceptions. The Act is not intended to allow certain behaviors, and we itemize those to make sure it's clear. The Act is not intended to prohibit a supervisor from requiring that an employee inform the supervisor as to official legislative requests for information. The Act is not intended to permit an employee to leave the employee's assigned work areas during normal work hours. It does not authorize an employee to represent the employee's personal opinions as the opinions of the agency. And except for subsection 2 of section 5, that is the wanted felon disclosure section, it does not authorize an employee to disclose information required to be kept confidential under state or federal law, rule, or regulation. This does not breach confidentiality laws, which may be in effect now or in the future. Finally, the Act is, the Act is not intended to restrict or preclude disciplinary action against an employee if the information disclosed by the employee is known to be false. In other words, it's malicious. Or the employee discloses the information with a reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the information. Furthermore, we provide that the employee may not receive immunity if they have any part in the wrongdoing that they're disclosing. They can't cover their tails this way by disclosing and saying, you can't get me.
You're welcome.
If they were involved in the violation, mismanagement, gross waste of funds, this does not offer them immunity. Also, we make clear that the Act does not restrict or impair any judicial right of action an employee or an employer has under existing law. We're not affecting tort or other liability. The Act does not prohibit a public employer from establishing by rule a procedure whereby an employee who wishes to disclose information under the Act may disclose the information first to a supervisor or someone else in the agency. Section 5 is the section that provides the procedure for revealing that a wanted felon is receiving services. It states it's a policy of the state that all public employees and their employees cooperate with law enforcement officials. When someone in, let's say, AFS determines that a client receiving services is or may be subject to a felony warrant for arrest, the procedure would be they would notify their immediate supervisor
or a person identified within the agency as the person to be notified in such cases. That notification should be prompt. The person notified, whether it's the supervisor or someone who's specifically named within that agency, would then have the responsibility to call the state police. A simple phone call, identify the person, or provide any other information that would help in identifying the person's identity, and the state police take it from there. They'll take the information and run it through the law enforcement data system and see what comes up. If the person is subject to a felony warrant for arrest, then the state police would notify local law enforcement authorities to proceed with the arrest in their normal channels. If the person is not, then we've determined that that's not a case to be pursued. In any case, the revelation of the name or the identity of the individual who is suspect to be subject to a felony warrant for arrest would only be allowed to be made to the immediate supervisor within the agency or the named person, and then to the state police. General disclosure is not protected. So in other words, you couldn't go to the newspapers and say so-and-so is a client, they're also a wanted felon. You would go through this process to the state police, who would handle it in a professional manner. That protects the liability of the state, and it also protects the interest of the individual if they are wrongly thought to be subject to a felony warrant for arrest. But if the procedure is followed, the individual employee reporting that suspect would be completely protected under the Act from retaliation by the employer. Section 6 provides that in addition to the appeal proceedings in state law for a state employee, if a person is injured, if a state employee alleges a violation of Section 3, that is the protections, then they may bring a civil action for injunctive relief or damages. Section 7 protects the identity of an employee during an investigation, so they can participate in the investigation without their name being disclosed to others, including the person being investigated. If the investigation results in either a criminal prosecution or a disciplinary action, then the name would be revealed within that, possibly. It would depend upon the nature of the investigation and whether their testimony was used. But this would protect the identity of the individual during the investigation phase. That echoes current law, which we're simply replacing with this new statute. Section 8 provides that violation of the Act would be an unfair labor practice, unlawful employment practice, excuse me. And I have one amendment to suggest on line 40 of page 3, and that would be to delete subsection 2 of, because it was inadvertent that we limited the application of the unlawful employment practice to part of section 3 rather than all of section 3. So I'd suggest you take a motion to delete subsection sub 2 of from line 40 on page 3. And finally, we have section 9 is the existing statute we're modifying. This is one that currently addresses some aspects of disclosure of wrongdoing. Section 10, there's a repeal of an existing statute that would be made moot by this new language. In Section 11, we have the emergency clause. I have with me today a woman from Springfield, a constituent. Karen Hulsey had some experience last year, some unfortunate experience, that triggered my interest in this issue. And she was employed by the Employment Division and revealed the fact that a client of the Employment Division participating in, it was Targeted Jobs Tax Credit Program, was a wanted felon from Washington State. She had violated probation on a felony drug charge. And the net result was, after some discussion within the agency, she took action and she was discharged for the action she took. I'd like to have Karen talk a little bit about her experience rather than me describe it. And I'd be glad to answer questions.
Are there questions of Senator Hill?
Senator, would you prefer that we ask questions after your witness testifies?
I think Karen can offer the best oversight of her experience and illustrate why this kind of protection is necessary.
Okay, because technical questions of the bill We'll wait now.
Go ahead, then. Give your name for the record.
My name is Karen Halsey, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1051. Until November 8th of 1988, I was an employee in the State of Oregon's Employment Division for over 12 years. I was terminated for what the State of Oregon called a flagrant violation of Employment Division policy. That flagrant violation was to notify a parole and probation officer that a particular person had come into the building. The only way I could identify this person was to have her pointed out to me by a co-employee. Once the person was pointed out to me, I notified the parole and probation officer that the individual he was looking for had arrived in the building. I had no idea why the parole and probation officer wanted to speak to this person, and I didn't know what her name was until I read it in the Springfield News. I am currently appealing the dismissal both through the union and privately. As a citizen of this state, I am certainly disturbed that a state employee can be fired for assisting the police in apprehending a wanted felon. As I understand Senator Hill's proposed bill, my actions, if it had been law, would not have been grounds for dismissal, but rather would have been required. All I did was assist the police in finding someone they had a warrant to arrest. I should not have been fired by the state of Oregon for that. And it's been 7.5 months. And finally, through negotiations, I will be going back to work.
Are there questions of the witness?
Thank you very much.
My name is Tony Corcoran. I'm a field representative for the Oregon Public Employees Union. And for your benefit, and since you're in session so long, I have laryngitis, so I'll be very brief. I'm a field representative for the University of Oregon Physical Plant. The physical plant is currently under an internal audit due to some allegations of mismanagement that and a concurrent problem in the physical plant was fear of intimidation by the workers of reprisals if they spoke up publicly about these problems in the physical plant. In February, two of the workers from the physical plant met with Senator Hill and discussed some of the issues that were going on there at the time, and then subsequently testified before the Senate Labor Committee on that issue. Those two gentlemen wouldn't come today, in part due to short notice and in part due to the treatment they received when they returned after the testimony. They were both taken in by their supervisors and asked real specific questions about what kind of testimony they gave, what kind of questions they were asked, and were concerned to some degree of retribution. And as Ms. Halsey's testified, her situation was a very extreme, overt retribution against her. There's also a variety of subtle forms of discrimination that take place when workers take this kind of action. What I've brought today for you is the written testimony that the workers provided Senator Hill's Labor Committee.
Thank you. Question for the witness? Representative Edmondson, you indicated a testimony.
Thank you. I guess just for the witnesses, as a fellow resident of Lane County, I think the community was outraged by the actions in Springfield, and I'm personally aware of the activities at the U of O, and I'm personally outraged by them as well. Senator Hill, excuse me, I wanted to ask you about Mr. Miller's letter. He sent us a letter and copied us a letter that he had sent earlier to you on this bill, and perhaps Ms. Clara is giving that to you. I think I understand his concern. I guess I'm glad to have that clarification because that's exactly the sort of law I want. But I just wanted to know if he says there that this would allow legislators to compel commentary from executive department employees on policy matters under discussion, which I think is just dandy. But I wonder if that is the intent here, as well as, if I read the bill, it seems to apply as well to local governments. Yeah. I think is also just dandy. I just want to make that clear from the sponsor's point of view.
I'd just like to point out, Fred is a good friend of mine, and we have a good relationship. We did talk about the bill on the Senate side, and I asked if he expressed some concerns of the executive department, but didn't have time to develop specific language to suggest. As a result of that discussion, I did insert on the first page, on line 25, in response to an official request to ensure that when a state employee talks to a legislator, they're talking to us in our official capacity. We're not using that for partisan purpose or private purpose. But frankly, if you look in Mason's manual defines our responsibility rather broadly. We have the ability and the responsibility to know about all phases of state government. We're the board of directors of this corporation. And we have to know, we have to be well informed, and we have to know the facts about how this corporation is running to make good decisions. If we depend only upon the CEO or his top assistants to tell us how the corporation is running, we may not have the correct picture. Now, I think we have an excellent CEO, and I think we have excellent top assistants to the CEO, but sometimes we don't get the full picture unless you go out in the shop, on the shop floor, and talk to the people doing the work. And that's what this does. This says, all it says is that the governor and the executive department and any agency head in the state or other public agency cannot prohibit, may not prohibit people talking to legislators in response to an official request about what's going on if it's not required to be confidential by state or federal law. If it's required to be confidential by state or federal law, we don't get to hear about it. See, so a children's services case is required to be confidential, names, things like that.
Yes, but Mr. Chairman.
But we're not supposed to know that, and this wouldn't let us know about those things required to be confidential. Things that aren't required, we could talk to state employees about.
Representative Woody.
Well, Senator, specific cases in Children's Services Division, but the recently publicized over $500,000 expenditure that's been in the paper would have certainly been able. I wonder how that got out. It certainly didn't get out by an audit.
And
I don't think it came out through the CEO.
I'm not sure which one you're talking about.
Talking about the booze, et cetera, is what I'm talking about.
Oh, AFS. You're talking AFS, about AFS. Absolutely.
Yeah,
okay.
I said the wrong thing.
Okay. AFS, there's allegations of leather portfolios worth $100 for AFS ponchos.
Yes.
And
how do you imagine that got out?
That got out by the employees. That got out from
the
employees.
That's all I'm going to say, Mr. Chairman.
And the same thing with Employment Division. The employees complained about misspent funds, about poor management, and in fact, we have new leadership in the Employment Division. We should be real clear about that. We have an excellent person leading the Employment Division now on an interim basis, Libby Leonard. She's outstanding. She's filling in because the last director left, in part because of the problems that the division encountered and the lack of morale of the employees. It's the employees who identify